So let's begin then. So Atif, thanks for joining me on the Reincarnated Obesity Panacea podcast. You were on once before, like 3-4 years ago.
Yeah, right after when I was in the boot camp.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And then you talked about a bunch of stuff that was like in press or not yet submitted, so we ended up cutting out like 2/3 of the actual podcast. But thank you for doing this, by the way. Are you wearing a plush shirt, by the way?
I'm wearing my plush shirt.
That's awesome.
This is... You know, I'm going to do an interview for Plus, and we're going to do this podcast. I'm about to wear the Plus shirt.
That's awesome. See, they only... The one time I met with them, when I was in San Francisco for a conference, they only had XXL t-shirts or something. So I've got it, but I never wear it because it just looks silly on me. It's like a muumuu.
There you go.
Yeah. So why don't you... To start, why don't you just briefly kind of explain who you are, what you do, and then we can go from there.
All right. So... So my name is Atif. I'm a fourth-year PhD at Queen's University in Canada. My research looks at the health of immigrant kids to Canada and how their health changes over time, so whether it gets better, whether it gets worse, whether it stays the same. In addition to that, I'm also a writer for PLOS Public Health Perspectives and PLOS Sci-Ed, so science education.
Cool.
And I'm interested in science communication especially, and particularly how we talk about science to the general public, to non-scientists and stuff like that.
And just because just to make sure I understand, is any of your like actual PhD research related to science communication, or is it very much an interest but sort of separate from your official academic stuff?
Yeah, it's completely separate. Oh, okay. My PhD there's nothing to do with science communication in that.
Okay, so you're like me.
Yeah, pretty much. You're like, this is fun and we enjoy it. And
right.
Yes.
And it would be wonderful if we could get paid for it, but we can't, so we'll do yeah. other things.
We can't get paid for it yet, but hopefully one day we'll get paid to do this and blog and be on Twitter.
Yes, yeah, that, living the dream. So so I guess, do you want to start then? How did you get interested in research? Because I'm always curious. Like, I find there are two types of people. People who got into research because they're just passionate about research generally. They're just like nerdy people that want to do science. And then there are other people who are super, super passionate about like a certain issue or topic and got into research so that they could better advocate that topic. And I'm curious sort of which was your path and how you wound up kind of getting to where you are.
Yeah, so I don't think we had this conversation, but my undergrad degree is actually in ecology.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so I studied, have you been to the Bay of Fundy?
Have I been to the Bay of Fundy?
Yeah.
Dude, I'm from New Brunswick. Yeah, of course. My healthcare card is a picture of the Bay of Fundy.
There you go. So in undergrad, I got a co-op job where I worked with a researcher at Carleton University, Mark Forbes, who studies the mud shrimp that live there.
Oh, cool.
So what it basically like this big... So in undergrad at Carleton where I was, you had three choices. Either you did genetics, okay. You did landscape ecology, you did ecology, or you did proteomics.
Okay.
Or like biochem, like, you know, part
yeah, yeah.
Like,
science intense stuff yeah.
Yeah, and I didn't enjoy any of that. Like, I didn't enjoy, like, doing PCRs, wetting gels, like, that stuff. I didn't get anything out of it. I found it way too, like, it was too much focus on the minutiae for me.
Okay.
I liked ecology because it was very big. It was very, like, how do we see this? How do we interact with it? And as people, how can we use this?
Yeah.
So I did that. So anyway, so we studied these mud shrimp with the Bay of Fundy, and they're ecologically really valuable because birds, when they're flying north, will stop there, eat these guys, and then fly north.
Okay.
And on the way south, they'll stop there, eat the mud shrimp, and then fly south.
Okay, cool.
So it's not just like that ecological niche that relies on it. It's them and wherever these birds are going to in the fall and the summer.
Okay.
So they're very important for that. So I started studying those, and I enjoyed that. By the time I got to the end of my undergrad, though, I didn't particularly want to stay in ecology, but I liked that sort of ecologic perspective on things.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Because I just found it was way more applied, it was way more interesting, and I think that's led to a lot of the health problems that we see. So this idea of, you know, how does the environment, how does your social, physical environment
okay.
affect the life?
So having like a big picture of things.
Yeah, of health in general.
Yeah. Right?
So ended up in epidemiology at Queen's, sort of serendipitously, and working with Will Pickett, Ian Jansen, Wendy Craig, looking at bullying
okay.
and obesity.
Yeah. Which is quite a departure from ecology.
It was, but it was also kind of the same sort of principle. You know, like, how does your environment affect you?
Okay. Yeah.
Right? So, you know, a lot of times we look at obesity and look at, like, what does it do to, like, the inside, like, your insides?
Yeah.
But for me, it's more like, well, how does it affect how you interact with the world? So how does it affect how, you know, energy expended, like, your social interactions, your work interactions, all of that sort of stuff? That's what I find more interesting.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I kind of ended up in that.
So and was that, sir, was that, like, did you go to work with them because you wanted to work on bullying and obesity type stuff? Or you knew they were good people, so you wanted to go work with them, and it just happened that that was sort of the project that they were all working on?
Yeah, it kind of worked out more of the latter. Like, I met, when I started at Queen's, it's one of the interesting parts of the program is that I didn't have to come in with a supervisor identified.
Oh, okay.
A lot of programs, you have to have a supervisor, and you come in, you're like, this is the project we're doing, and you hit the ground running. At Queen's, at the time when I started, in the program that I was in, we didn't have that.
Okay.
So it's about four, like, a lot of people did, just by virtue of that, but every year a couple of people don't, and I didn't. I met with a few people, and that's when we kind of talked. He was like, well, you know, this is a question that we want to look at. Are you interested?
That's good. You wound up with some good people. You're you know, that's pretty serendipitous to wind up with those three people, you know, not having a supervisor. That's a pretty good group.
I look back on it. That was a very fortuitous conversation because it's now been 7 years, and like I've done I did my undergrad with the, I was in my master's with them. I worked and I came back. We're going to do my PhD on the same, on similar sort of things, but with the same people.
Yeah.
And it's been a phenomenal experience. I had a real great time. Yeah. So I think of the two, like it's, I'm really interested. If the scientific thing I'm interested in is really how people interact with each other and how that affects your health behaviors.
Okay.
So, almost social network theory, but not quite.
Okay.
So, you know, how, like, if you have friends who go out and play soccer every week, then you're going to go out and play soccer every week. If you have friends who go out drinking every week, then you go out drinking every week. So that kind of, those kinds of things really impact how you behave and thus your health.
Right. Well, it's very intuitive. That's why I like epi stuff generally, because it's very easy to, like, explain to your parents why it matters, you know? Like, as opposed to the molecular stuff, like, it's just like, oh, okay, that makes sense. Like, yeah, what you're doing, okay, that I get that. And so, so your master stuff, the last time we had you on the podcast, it was still not published, so we talked about it, but then never actually published it. So what was your actual, like, master's findings?
Yeah, so the master's stuff was two papers. First, looking at, basically, it was like one paper was a longitudinal study looking at if you had two kids, one normal weight, one obese.
Yeah.
And neither of them were bullied in the first year, and then 1 year later, was the obese kid more likely to be bullied than the non-obese kid?
And I'm going to assume they were?
They were.
Yeah.
But for specific forms of bullying, I forget the exact form, but I think it was just relational bullying.
Okay.
So that's like social exclusion, making fun of you, calling you names, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Not for physical bullying, so like punching, kicking, fighting.
Okay.
What we find with boys is that interestingly enough, that if you're bigger, you're better able to defend yourself, is what we suspect.
Yeah.
And as a bigger boy, you're able to defend yourself, and so you can fight back.
Right.
Whereas relational boys are being excluded from activities that you can't, like, your size is not a factor. It won't help you.
Okay. And so then, did you look at boys and girls, or just boys?
Yeah, boys and girls.
And so then I assume, because it seems like boys are more the physical bullying and girls are more relational bullying, so was it worse in girls or was it worse in boys? Or was it similar?
So the second paper that we looked at weapon carrying in boys and girls. And seeing if you were bullied, were you more likely to carry a weapon?
How old are these kids you're looking at?
10 to 16.
And this is Kingston?
This is national. So all across Canada.
Well, this is a CCHS, is it?
HBSC.
Okay.
The Health Behaviour School Service. It's a national survey of kids in all provinces and territories. I believe that samples all provinces and territories across Canada.
Okay.
And we looked at boys and girls, and we found that girls were more likely to carry weapons if they were bullied and obese.
Really?
Yeah.
And so... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so I was going to say, that one was an interesting study from an academic perspective. Like, it was an interesting study in terms of the findings, but what was more interesting was that was the one that I think I talked to you about this before, where it was rejected like four different places before it got out.
Yeah, that's where you were last time we talked. It was like,
it was in that academic limbo.
Yeah.
And it got published. And as soon as it got published, like they put out a little press release. and Audio Sharma blogged about it.
Okay, yeah, yeah, I remember that.
Next thing I know, I was getting calls from like all of the different media organizations.
Yeah.
This is like first year of my PhD. This is one of the reasons why I ended up in science writing. It was one of the first things that came out of my PhD. And we, like that week, I was getting calls from the National Post.
That's really cool.
It was surreal to be like, okay, this paper, it took us a year and a half to get, like, almost 2 years to get it published.
Yeah.
And when it got published, people want to hear about it.
Right, so right.
The gap between, you know, scientifically, it wasn't desirable.
And so what were the concerns? Was it because it was, like, I mean, it's a big sample, it seems interesting, so it seems like the kind of thing that wouldn't be tough to publish.
So the problem was that we were looking at kids who, like, were incident cases of bullying. So kids who weren't bullied at time one.
Okay.
But then bullied at time two.
Yeah.
And so what happened was, I mean, if you take out all the kids who weren't bullied at time one, that reduces your sample a lot.
Yeah.
And then if you look at the kids who were newly bullied at time two, that reduces your sample even further.
Okay.
So from a scientific perspective, we weren't able to control for a lot of things.
Okay.
So as an academic, you'd be like, well, you know, you can't really do much with it. It's not that,
right.
Like, it's not that scientifically.
Right.
Like, you need to do a bigger study to get the findings.
Right. I'm picturing if Yoni Friedhoff were blogging about this and it was a diet study, he would point out the 18 things that you didn't adjust for.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And that was a fact. That's why you get trouble publishing it.
Right.
Because the primary concern was it was a small sample size.
Yeah.
But then when it actually got out there, people were, like, the public isn't really, I mean, some of the public will be interested, obviously, in the small sample size and the methodology and stuff. But typically, people are more interested in, well, what does this mean and how do we deal with it?
Right, yeah, yeah.
What can we do with this?
Yeah. And so what can you do with it then? So what was the take-home message from that in terms of, like, policy or schools or parents? So
we were very cautious about the way we interpreted it. We were very kind of guarded in saying, look, this is just a preliminary study. We found this. We can't make broad sweeping generalizations about it. The biggest limitation that we had was we couldn't see why kids were carrying weapons.
Okay.
So we weren't sure if that was a response to bullying or whether it was a response to something else.
Okay.
And so that was one of the biggest concerns. But we don't know if they're carrying weapons because of bullying or if they're carrying weapons because of something else.
And something else being, like, they live in a bad neighborhood or something?
A bad neighborhood, it's culturally appropriate. Like, we did exclude knives from the paper.
Okay.
Especially in rural, like, I mean, I was a Boy Scout, and I carried a penknife all the time.
Okay.
You know, like, just, it's one of those things, like, you know, like, you're a kid, you carry a penknife. It's just, you know, you, especially if you live in a rural community, right?
Right, right.
So we excluded those, but kids were still carrying on, like, sticks and clubs and things like that.
That's really crazy.
Yeah. And so we were kind of like, well, we can't say too much about this. What we did want to stress to people was, especially with bullying, we need to take a similar sort of approach that we have to racism.
Okay.
And to, because of the issue with the obesity and bullying is that a lot of times you look at it and say, well, a message you want to avoid saying at all costs is, if only these kids weren't obese, they wouldn't be bullied.
Right, of course, yeah. Or we should target all the obese kids because they're the ones with all the weapons.
Or even we should target all the obese kids because they're the ones being bullied.
Right.
If you replace obesity with race in that, well,
right.
All the black kids being bullied, you wouldn't target all of them for the intervention.
Because, right.
Right?
Yeah.
But it's one of those things that it's not immediately apparent.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what we've stressed was that it should be a school-based intervention, especially a procedure known as bystander empowerment.
Okay. So to make people feel like they should tell somebody to shut up if they're being mean?
Exactly. So you see somebody being bullied, you should feel empowered that you can step in and stop that behavior.
Right.
And that's for all kinds of bullying, whether that's by gender, by race, by weight, by characteristics, anything like that. You step in and say that's not appropriate, and you denormalize the behavior.
Yeah.
And so that was, like, the big message that I tried to stress.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was the big message that we tried to stress, along with the fact that we really, it was a preliminary study. So you'd have to get more information, you'd have to do more work to really make some decisions about it.
Now, as someone who's studying bullying, or has studied it, do you find it interesting? Because I find, and I've been thinking over some sort of blog post about this for a long time, because I'm always surprised at, like, the most progressive, liberal-minded people I know who would you know, step in immediately if someone made a racial slur in a casual conversation or something homophobic. I'm thinking of one guy in particular who wouldn't, you know, would stop anyone from saying anything like that. But then one day he just off the cuff said he made a mistake. He's like, "Oh, I'm such a dumbass." Well, better a dumbass than a fat ass. And he laughed and walked away. And it was, but it was one of those things that it was totally not a big deal to him. And I was, it really struck me because he would stop anyone from being, you know, saying something like that. So do you find that with obesity, or does that sort of strike you as it being more socially appropriate still than other forms of bullying in some ways?
I don't know about another form of bullying specifically, but I know just in, I mean, in general, you're right. Like, there's a definite attitude towards bullying that doesn't exist towards other things. And I know last time we spoke about this, where we talked about the language that we use.
Okay, I'm not sure. Sorry, go ahead.
Say like an obese person, so right? Doesn't buy their weight, but you would never say the language is not shifting on disability, where it's not a disabled person, it's a person with disability.
Yeah, it's not a diabetic or an autistic kid, it's a kid with diabetes or autism. Like you're not defined by this issue. Yeah,
exactly. And so that's kind of the big change that I think is coming with the discussion around obesity and how to tackle it, and especially last year with the American Medical Association and their decision to classify obesity as a disease.
Yeah.
I think that's a really important move in order to just get people help if they need it and if they want it.
So you follow on Sharma's side of that equation, that labeling it as a disease will be beneficial and not harmful?
I hope so.
I agree.
I think there's definitely the potential for harm. But I think ultimately, last year I broke my arm, right?
Yeah.
A biking accident, broke my arm, needed to get, I had 30-something stitches, to seal it up. And then
I remember the pictures on Facebook, yeah.
Yeah, in the emoji, I'm like, can somebody take a picture of that? So please, I can tweet this later. The doctor was not impressed. But after that happened, right, so I needed help. So, I had the doctors help me out, I had nurses, I had people help, I had all of that sort of follow-up appointments, I had, my physio was not fully covered, it was half covered by my student health insurance.
Right.
And so, I had help and support all the way through the healing process. Mm-hmm. Now, if I had a weight issue and I wanted to get help for it, I say, I want to get help. I want to help somebody to help me with my diet or with the activity or my lifestyle or whatever.
Yeah.
None of that is covered.
Right.
Which is very striking to me, where it's still a health concern. But if it was a physical problem, like my arm or, something like that, you would get covered. But because it's this, it's not covered. So my hope is that by making it a disease, it'll mean that insurance companies will decide to cover it.
Right.
Whether or not they will remains to be seen, especially in the U.S., now that the Affordable Care Act is now up and running.
Yeah.
How the government decides to proceed with it. They don't know that they've actually done anything about it yet. I think they were more concerned about just the rollout.
Right, yeah, I don't... Yeah, they're still working out the website before they get to obesity. Yeah. No, that, and I agree. Because I was talking to somebody the other day, and they asked, which side am I on? Am I on the... health at every size side, or the label it a disease side. I'm sort of indifferent as long as the treatment that is available, medical treatment and just interpersonal treatment of people with obesity gets better. I don't really care which path we go down, so long as we get to the same endpoint.
And this is one thing that I find a lot that happens a lot. It's kind of a political thing that's kind of seeped into public health, where it's you're either with me or against me.
And me being the person with disease, or?
Whatever your perspective is.
Okay.
Is it a disease, yes or no? Well, what does the definition matter as much as the outcome?
Right.
So, when I think about health, like you said, I think there's a lot of good that comes from it. I think it's a great perspective on it. That being said, if somebody wants to lose weight, that's their choice. They can still be healthy.
And yeah, they should
Do it in a way that's, I talked to some people at the Obesity Summit about it, and I think it's a great perspective, and I think there's merit in that. If somebody wants to lose weight, I don't think that they should be shamed because of it.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And if somebody doesn't, that's their choice. It's an individual decision, but I think we should give them support to do whatever it is they want to do.
Yeah. When I sort of lump health at every size with Gary Taubes, not in terms of their views on obesity, but in terms of like 80-90% I think is awesome. The last like 10% I think is just makes no sense. But I'm willing to, you know, it's the same thing when I read Taubes' books. Like, oh yeah, like 80% of this is fantastic, and 10% is just crazy. And not that I'm saying that it's crazy, but you know what I mean? That like certain things like that, like you hear of people that have had really strange experiences sometimes with well-meaning people who have taken things too far, and you know, like are really, you know, bashing someone for losing weight for their health if it was recommended by their physician or something. So yeah, I agree entirely.
And the problem is, I think it comes on both sides, right? You get the, I mean, we had this conversation last year where we said, when we went to get a physical done, and like your doctor and my doctor, two different doctors, told us both to lose weight.
Your doctor told you to? Oh, I didn't remember that. Oh, that's awesome. I mean, yeah.
Oh, I went in for a physical last year.
Yeah.
Took my height and weight. Doctor sits down, like, and like, so, you know, what do you do? I'm a grad student. You get an exercise. Like, oh, you know, and this was in the summer. So, yeah, I'm playing Ultimate twice, like, Ultimate Games twice a week, practice twice a week. I'm lifting weights just 3 days. Like, you know, I'm like, every day of the week I'm getting exercise. I'm walking to and from work, which is like a 6K round trip. Like, I'm getting, you know, she's like, well, the BMI is 25.1. Little weight. I'm like, what?
Yeah, I know.
Listen to the rest of it. And it's like 25.1. Like, I forget exactly what it was. It was just above 25.
Right, right.
Oh, you lose weight. I'm like, did you not listen to the rest of what I was saying?
No, I know. And that was in mine because I was like 24.3 or something. And it wasn't my nurse practitioner. It was like the nurse who does like the eye test and height and weight beforehand. And to her credit, my nurse practitioner had done the long history and we talked about like personal training. So never talked about that. But yeah, the initial nurse, when she took my height and weight, said, oh, you're 24.3. You might want to watch your weight because once you get over 25, your health risk starts to go up quite quickly. And I, in my head, I just kept thinking, this isn't evidence-based healthcare. And then, but I couldn't think of anything like, anything to say that made sense that wouldn't just like come out as a stream of like, I didn't know how to approach it well. So I actually printed out like the Edmonton Obesity Staging System for my next appointment, and then they never mentioned it again. But so I was ready that time to be like, here is what you should maybe consider. You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and then, so I know we're getting sort of near the end time-wise. So since your master's, so you worked for a year. And
yes.
And did you always know you were coming back to grad school? Or did you, what was the plan there?
Yeah, so the best advice I got, actually, was from my supervisors when I left.
Yeah.
So I wanted to come back and do my PhD, but their advice was that if you do leave, make sure you have a plan to come back.
Oh, okay.
Give yourself 2 years. You know, go work for 1 year. In your second year, apply and start. So the third year after graduation, that third September, you're back in school.
Oh, okay. That's good advice.
And it's really, like, what I tell actually all the master's students who are coming out now, I tell them, like, make sure you have an exit strategy, because the problem is that as a grad student, you get used to living on a certain budget, typically, like, less than 20 grand a year. Kind of, as the master's level, the PhD is a little more, but you know, you're looking at living below 30. If you're earning more than 30 grand as a grad student, you're doing really well.
Yeah, yeah. And might I say, as a postdoc as well, I'm learning quickly.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah,
right?
And if you're lucky enough to have a postdoc, period.
This is also true.
Yeah, the story, go on.
But, yeah, so the advice they gave me was, you know, make sure you're going to come back. Like, come back and get, so give yourself 3 years and then come back in the third of September. Because once you start working, you don't, like, it's very difficult, because I was paying, the way I illustrated that for students is, I was paying more in taxes every 2 weeks than I was getting paid on a monthly basis as a grad student. Like, yeah, it was just the most surreal experience to think, oh, right, I'm getting paid. And that's the tough part, right? Because once you get used to that, that money, that standard of living, the flexibility, the lack, like, depending on the job, you may actually work 9 to 5.
Yeah.
And then go home, you don't have to worry about it. Like, it's a very different perspective to what we're used to as grad students. So.
And so why did you come back then, given that you were making money and had a life?
Money. In all honesty, it came down to what I want to do in my career. The way my supervisor put it is that with a master's degree, you can answer somebody else's questions.
Yeah.
With a PhD, you can answer your own questions.
Okay, yeah.
And so I have like my PhD research and things I want to do afterwards, they're questions that I want to look into, but I wouldn't be able to do that working for somebody else. I would have to be the PI in a project.
Okay. No, that makes sense. And so is that your plan, or are you still sort of trying to decide what the plan is, like I am?
Yeah, it depends on the day of the week.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you.
And that's the one thing I figured. So yeah, so in the first year I started blogging myself. And then I think about 6 to 8 months later, PLOS expanded and they added the public health and the SciEd blog along with a couple of others. And so I was invited to join.
It was that short. I thought you'd been blogging longer when you got the call.
Well, I think it's been just about, maybe it's about 6 to 8 months. Wow. And then we talked about by the time of launch happened, it wasn't that long.
Yeah.
So I think I started in July of 2012.
Okay.
And then we launched a PLOS, I think, of September or October of 2013. So maybe it was about a year, but then we had to go through all the paperwork and last beforehand. But yeah, that kind of exposed me to a whole other world of things where it's a very different mentality, it's a very different writing style.
Yeah.
The academic perspective. And it's fun. I can write, you know, things that are outside of...
Right.
But it's nice because I can write things that are outside of my expertise. And also I can put them in ways that I find more engaging.
Yeah. And do you find it refreshing? I find it actually refreshes me when I go back to my academic writing because I'm able to think like, oh, I actually still like science, right? I can read these other things as opposed to like rereading the same 6 papers that you read every week trying to shoehorn them into your introduction.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely a lot of fun. It's liberating, right? Like I'm working on a post for public health right now where I'll tell you about it, but it's going up tomorrow.
Okay.
But it's basically talking about the differences between like in sport, so watching sports like as a spectator and as a fan versus as a public health person.
Oh, okay.
Where when I see it came to me last week, I was watching the NFC Championship game.
Okay.
And it was like the end of the fourth quarter and Navarro Bowman for the 49ers.
Yeah.
He just bent in ways that he should not bend.
Yeah, I looked away every time I watched the highlights. They're like, if you're squeamish, I looked away.
Yeah, like I'm, nope, don't want to see that.
Yeah, yeah.
No, but as a sports fan, right, it's very different watching that too as a public health person. You're like, wow, that's, yikes.
Yeah.
And that was an extreme example, but there's also, you know, the big hits in hockey. You see those things. And you look at those, and as a fan, you're like, that's awesome. Like, the big hits, they're exciting. Yeah, they go on the top 10 highlight reels. And then, as a public health person, like, ooh, brain injuries.
Yeah. Like, no, I think exactly. Like, I grew up playing hockey, and I had, like, 4 or 5 concussions. Yeah. And played through some, I mean, they're all very minor ones, and, like, played through, like, damaged ankles and stuff and didn't think anything of it. Now I'm like, you know, that's really not good to be encouraging like 15-year-old kids to play through brain injuries.
Exactly.
You know?
Well, that's it, right? So it's kind of reconciled. And the thing is that like, the more I do that, the more I look into it, the more I'm like, okay, this is an interesting question, but I'd never be able to write about it academically.
Right.
Because it's not really an academic issue. It's a very, like, it's a more reflective kind of opinion piece that I wouldn't be able to write, but as a science writer, as a blogger, it's the perfect venue to go into that.
Right, and you can actually impact more people, because if you're writing even an editorial, it's only going to be read by a few other academics, whereas if on the blog, it could be read by, you know, soccer moms and teachers and people who actually, you know, can sort of take it and run with it.
Yeah,
and exactly. So just to finish that, I don't want to take too much of your time. Sort of, do you want to talk about what you're working on now, and do you have any papers out from your PhD that you can talk about, or if not, you can talk about very general terms, sort of what you're doing, whatever you're comfortable talking about.
So generally, I'm kind of working on a number of things. My basic PhD research is looking at this concept of what's called acculturation.
Yeah.
So when somebody moves to a new country, so it's particularly in Canada, but even it's been studied a lot in Canada and the US and a little bit in Europe, but and Australia actually is a big spot. But it looks at when two cultures meet, two very different, distinct cultures, how do people adapt and how do they balance the retention of like where they came from at their host culture and adoption of the new cultures, their host culture.
Okay.
So you can imagine somewhere like Canada that promotes retention of both. So there's multiculturalism. You say you can keep your beliefs. You have to adopt these Canadian beliefs, but you can make them work as part of a group.
Yeah, yeah.
So what I'm doing for my PhD is really looking at how can we measure that in kids.
Oh, wow.
Because every year, Canada admits about 250,000 new immigrants.
Okay.
Which is a city the size of Kingston.
I know, I was just going to say, that's like even bigger than Kingston, isn't it? That's a pretty big city.
150 maybe in Kingston?
Yeah, that's bigger than any city in New Brunswick. So yeah, yes. It's big enough.
Yeah, and so, and all of those, and the thing, the Kingston icon was interesting is that those, that's a whole number, right? If you look at that, the number of people below the age of 14 is about 50 to 60,000 a year.
Okay.
So every year you have about 50,000 youth below the age of 14 immigrating to Canada.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are coming from East and Southeast Asia, so China, Japan, the Philippines, South Asia, so India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Africa, and then a lot of European countries. And so what they're doing is they're coming in, they've got their own belief system, their own structure, their own language, and they're coming to Canada, and now they have to integrate Canadian life. And these guys, I mean, they're young, right? So they're going to, whatever decisions they make, whether it be around healthy behaviors, unhealthy behaviors, healthy attitudes, unhealthy attitudes, all of those things will stay, could have the potential to be with them for the next 50, 60, 70 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, you got a kid who moves here who starts smoking because he thinks that that's what Canadians, quote, do. You know, you've got 60 years of smoking ahead of you.
Okay, so still looking at how this acculturation then sort of relates back to health in the bigger picture.
Exactly. So one of the studies in my PhD is really going to look at how you measure that.
Right.
Because a lot of the problems are is that these questionnaires that exist have been developed for specific groups.
Okay.
Because you can imagine, like a person who comes from a Muslim country, religion is a large part of their identity. Somebody who comes from another country, religion may not be a large part, but language and dance may be a large part of their identity. And so, whereas other countries, language may not be as big an issue, but something else might be. So it's to balance all of those things together to form a questionnaire that can be used for any kid.
Right, yeah, that seems like a very nebulous, difficult thing methodologically to get nailed down.
Yeah. And it's... Because a lot of the research has been done in the U.S., a lot of the research is focused on groups that are important to the U.S. So the Hispanic population, the Asian American population, the black population.
Right.
And so that's been the focus, whereas in Canada that's not the case. They've got East and Southeast Asia and South Asia.
Right.
With their own health risks and their own health behaviors.
That's very cool. And so then, so sort of the same question I asked about your master's, was this a project that was driven by your supervisors, or was this... sort of driven by your own experience moving to Canada, or the confluence of all those things?
Mainly by myself, actually. The PhD was very, like, you have to come up, like, as they typically do.
Yeah, that's cool.
You flesh it out, you come to us, and then we'll give you feedback on it and tell you what is and isn't doable.
Right.
So that's kind of been the PhD process, which has been nice. It's very academically and intellectually liberating.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, so that's kind of been that process. It's been fun. It's been a lot of fun. And it's been a really good learning experience for sure.
Good. And so year four, so you're like collecting data, trying to write things up, that sort of stage now?
Yeah, so actually the way that my PhD was set up is that there was a number of different studies all happening simultaneously.
Okay, that was like mine, yeah.
Yeah, so you're trying to finish, like some of them you try and start early so you can finish up early.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of them, like, they, you know, they're going to take longer, so you start them and you leave them a little bit. You have to wait for stuff to come in.
Yeah, that's smart.
And so, yeah, that's kind of where that's at, which has been an interesting sort of balancing act. We're like, this one takes a little bit of time, but then I can't work on anything else, versus this one that if I do a little bit of time now, then I can work on this other one. And
I spent like two and a half years working on my big intervention. And then I spent like 3 months working on one study and then like 2 months working on another, just based on, you know, I had to collect my own data for two of the papers and the other one's data was collected and already cleaned and ready for me. So yeah, it definitely changes things. Well, Atif, I think that's probably a good spot to end it. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about?
No, I think that's about it. You're doing well.
Yeah. Things are good. Yeah. We've been in Halifax for 3 weeks now. Postdoc's going well. I'm learning about latent class growth analysis, which is cool.
I'm doing that, actually.
Are you? Good for you. Are you doing it in SAS? A little proc trad or M plus?
Yeah. Actually, you know what? Let's wrap this up and I'll stop recording this so we can actually wear like non
before we nerd out. Okay, well then before we stop recording, have you stopped already?
No.
Okay, then why don't you tell people, for people that see it on my blog or on YouTube or the podcast, where they can find you then?
Okay, so we'll post a link to it on the post, but if you go to MrEpidemiology.com, so Mr. E-P-I-D, oh God, I can't spell the rest of it, MIOLOGY.com, you'll find it. I'm also on the PLOS blog network under their Public Health Perspectives blog and their Science Education blog, and you can follow me on Twitter at Mr. Epid.
That's, yeah, Mr. M-R-E-P-I-D, not a skin doctor. And, yeah, and I can, for anyone who hasn't found our blog, you can find me at PLOS Blogs at Obesity Panacea and on Twitter at Travis Saunders. So thanks, Atif, and I really appreciate you being back, the first person on this new version of PLOS Blogs. And now let's nerd out and talk about some stats programs.
It sounds good.